It's actually, what do you think happens when an ant gets sick?
I had no idea that ants could fall sick, and I have no idea what happens when they do.
Well, that's perfect, because we're about to find out.
The science basement.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to the Science Basement Podcast, a podcast for people who love all things science. I'm your host, Katya.
And I'm your co-host, Pratakshi.
And today we will be talking about ant social behavior, particularly about self-medication behavior in ants, a topic that is relatively understudied. But before we dive into the episode, Pratakshi, this is your first episode as a host, right? Do you want to introduce yourself briefly for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So, hello everyone. I've been with the Science Basement for quite some time now, but this is my first time in front of the mic. I'm super excited to be here, and I have a master's in neuroscience, and I'm currently working as a project assistant, and I'm based in India. So, I'm really, really looking forward to this conversation.
And we're so happy to have you with us. We are joined today by Jason Rissanen, a PhD student at the University of Graz in Austria. Jason has a background in ecology and evolutionary biology and an affinity towards behavioral ecology. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. So let's dive right in. Jason, you study ant behavior and other social insects. Could you tell us a bit more about your topic and what you study?
Yeah, so I study self-medication behaviors in ants. So pretty much what ants do when they get sick, what kind of compounds they use as medicine to clear their diseases a little bit faster.
So, what is self-medication?
So self-medication is, it's pretty self-explanatory. It's when you get sick and you need something to cure yourself with, so you use medicine to combat against the disease. But it does have a fancier definition, sort of, that entails everything, and it is the deliberate and costly use of biologically active compounds to combat disease. This definition is important to make sure that it's this strict behavior and not other behaviors that are kind of like it.
Right, that makes a lot of sense.
That's super interesting. So, why did you choose ants?
I've always liked ants, and I think ants are pretty cool. And if you want to study behaviors, ants are a pretty good system to do it, especially because it's not just like individuals that you would have with some other animals, but they are the entire ant colony as well. So you have two different levels of studying this behavior in.
So, how do these ant colonies operate?
Well, an ant colony is a really complex society in a way, where you have these different castes of individuals. So you have the workers who are tasked with foraging the food and maintaining the colony and brood care, for example. And then you have a specialized caste for reproduction as well. So you have the queens whose job it is to lay all the eggs. But contrary to sort of common belief, it is not the queen who runs the colony in any way. She's just there to pretty much make the babies, and the workers are the ones who actually make the big decisions for the colony.
Oh wow, that's so, yeah, I definitely thought that it was the queen who was like the big boss and ran the whole show. So if it's predominantly some of the workers then running the colony, is it somehow like how related they are to each other that affects their status in the ant society?
In a way, yeah. I mean, there is not much status in a colony, and the workers are just working together to produce more offspring because all of the workers in a colony, they're sisters to each other, right? So the queen lays all the eggs, and from these hatch the workers, and they're all sisters to each other. And because of a sort of quirky thing, how these eggs are fertilized, the sisters have a very high relatedness towards each other. So it is actually more beneficial for them to produce more sisters than their own daughters. And that's one of the reasons what are driving this big cooperation between the workers and why the colonies then are so successful.
Oh wow. So wait, they're more genetically related to their sisters than their daughters.
And their mother, yeah.
Wow. Okay. That's quite confusing to wrap my head around. Very cool.
If we think of it sort of in human terms, you get like 50% from your mother and 50% from your father, and your daughters and your sons would also be 50% related to you, and as well as your sisters. That's because we get like one pair of chromosomes from both our mother and our father. But ants are what we call haplodiploid. So the fertilized eggs are diploid, and they will be the daughters, and then the fathers have only one pair. of chromosomes. And then this leads to the sisters having a relatedness of 75% to each other, and then only 50% to their father and 50% to their own offspring. So to keep their genes alive in the world, it's actually better for them to produce more sisters.
Oh, wow. Okay, so haploid, just as a general recap of definitions, haploid means that you get half of the genetic contents?
Yeah, it's having one chromosome, and diploid is having a pair of chromosomes.
Okay, that's super interesting. But so self-medication behavior in ants, how did you become interested in this topic? It seems pretty niche.
Yeah, it is very niche. And I sort of came at it from the opposite angle. I've always been interested in behavior, and especially like behavioral manipulations. And I think it's really, really cool when you have these diseases that are changing the behaviors of the host. And there's plenty of examples in ants. We have the classic example being the Ophiocordyceps fungi that makes zombies out of the ants and takes over their muscles, and they make them climb up trees, and then the fungus is sprouting out of their heads and spreading the spores. So this is, of course, very cool and fascinating, and that's what I wanted to research at first, but then I got a chance in the project to look at the other side, so still how diseases are affecting the behavior of the host, but now for the benefit of the host instead of the pathogen.
Wait, zombie ants. Very cool. Okay, so first you were interested in kind of the pathogen caused behavior changes, but then now I guess you're researching the self-medication behavior. How did you make that jump?
Well, the simple question is that there was a project and I sort of talked my way into it. And then that's how I got started with the self-medication. I mean, it's still sort of within why I'm interested in these behaviors, that sort of pathogen-caused behavioral changes, but it's just from the other side. And in ants especially, it's all really interesting because ants are like, should be dying of diseases left and right if we listen to the experts, because they're considered to be like really susceptible for all sorts of pathogen outbreaks. Because like I said before about the relatedness, if you have a low genetic diversity, you're more susceptible to disease outbreaks, because if there's one individual in the colony who can get infected, the likelihood that all the others can get infected as well are much, much higher. So
right. And you said that they were, was it 75% related to most of the colony?
Yeah, exactly. So they have a very low genetic diversity, and there's also like millions of them in the same place, and they're frequent, they interact and everything. So if you just listen to most of the experts, the ants should be dying left and right because of the diseases. But then again, at the same time, they have these all sorts of adaptations towards this higher pathogen threat, like their immune system, and they have physiological features like specialized glands. But mostly what I believe is that they're using lots of different behaviors. You have the classical ones, like the hygienic behaviors. They are very good at grooming themselves and other ants in the colony, and they can disinfect stuff when they bring it in. But then we have this self-medication behavior, which is still relatively new to the scene. I think it was pretty much defined in like the early 90s, and the definitions are still changing. So it's a completely new thing. And it's been shown like in ants maybe like 7 years ago, but that was pretty much it. And we still have no ideas how this entire behavior actually works, how it's affected, and then especially bringing it back to the colony level again. So how the society of ants are behaving and medicating, it's stuff that no one really knows about. So it was really easy to get very interested in the end.
That is super, super fascinating. Yesan. And is this topic like widely studied? And like, how much do we actually know about this behavior, especially in ants or in other animals?
So, I mean, for a really long time, medication was something that we thought that only humans can do, right? Because humans are the smartest, most amazing creatures, and all the other animals are dumb, pretty much. We're pretty good at putting ourselves on a pedestal as humans. But then I think it started in the 60s when they started seeing monkeys eat these leaves that have no nutritional value, and no one really knew why. And then they found out that eating these leaves were like clearing their parasites and stuff. So that's where the animal medication sort of got its start, because it's also easier for humans to go like, well, monkeys are also pretty smart. You started seeing it in chimpanzees, and then in baboons, and then deer. So we started going that way. And then for the frustration of many, you started seeing this in insects as well, like monarch butterflies can self-medicate actually their offspring by choosing which plants they lay their eggs on, if there's more or less parasites around. And then in ants, finally, it was also shown that they can use foods with hydrogen peroxide to clear a fungal disease. And that's sort of where I started as well after that one. So I'm sort of continuing that research. It's become a widely sort of accepted behavior in animals, but it's still very, very understudied. We don't really know how any of them do it in nature, for example.
You already mentioned the vertebrate bias that we have. So anything with like a spine, we're like, oh yes, they must be super smart and clever. But I was pretty surprised when you were talking about your topic the first time that I heard you talk about it. I was like, wow, like ants self-medication, that's super cool. And I think it's very important that we are, and that you are studying this and looking into it. So you already briefly mentioned hydrogen peroxide as something. So I guess that's something we'll hear more about, what it means and how you do it in this next part, because we'd really like to hear about the methods that you use. How do you actually conduct your studies? What methods do you use?
Because I'm studying behaviors, my methods are different behavioral assays. And because I'm studying mostly medicinal compounds that are digestible, a lot of my methods are around following their foraging behavior according to if they're sick or if they're healthy. So it's quite a simple setup in a way. I use colonies of ants and I can count as many ant workers I want. And if it's species with multiple queens, I can even put like queens from the same nests into two different boxes and then the workers, and I can infect the other box with a fungal disease and keep the other one healthy. And then I give them usually different diets and I follow their foraging behavior to look at which choices the ants are making on different foods, if they're sick or if they're healthy. And then following if I can see differences in mortality in the colonies, for example, to see if the choices that they made actually made them more healthy when they're sick compared to if they, let's say, don't have access to these medicinal compounds.
How many ants are there in like your typical experiment?
It really depends. And I have a tendency of making my experiments sort of balloon a little bit. But I did one experiment a couple of summers ago where I used 135 colonies of ants and I had 100 workers each. So it was 13,500 ants that I needed to count. And that was just for one experiment. So.
Oh my gosh. So wait, you said you have to count them. How on earth do you keep track of them?
Yeah, we have to count them. It sounds like a lot of work, and in a way it is, but you also get sort of very used to it and you even miss it at sometimes. But I mean, basically we dig out an entire colony and then we put them in buckets. And from those buckets, we count the ants sort of one by one into smaller buckets. So if we have them.
I guess you really have to get into this zen mode to be counting 13,500 ants.
Yeah, I mean, I also usually have help, so I don't have to count them all usually by myself. But I mean, that has happened too. It just takes time. You know, you dig up a colony that can have 10,000 workers, so counting 100 of those is pretty fast.
Yeah, but fortunately, you get help every once in a while. Sounds like a lot of work. Painstaking. That's a lot of ants. And you said that you give them different kinds of treatments, like sometimes they're controlled, sometimes they're even like sick or have different medication. How do you actually differentiate between your different groups? Because I guess an ant looks like an ant at the end of the day.
I mean, usually in many of my experiments, I have like the full colony either infected and the full colony either as controls. But I have done experiments where I had like half of the colonies were infected as well. And to know which ones were healthy and which ones weren't, I had to paint the either infected ants or the control ants. So to keep track of which ones were which, and I could see if it was an infected ant that was going to eat food and or a healthy ant that was going to eat food as well. And then because I needed to paint like half the ants in that colony, I needed to paint half the ants in all of the colonies, which turned out to be painting 6,750 ants individually with this very fancy red nail polish.
I'm going to think about nail painting very differently now that I know that it's also used to paint ants.
It's a very special one. It's only meant for insects, but if you ask anyone, it's going to be pretty much red nail polish.
Okay, makes sense that it's not quite the same that we get from the stores.
So you mentioned that they're making different food choices depending on whether they are sick or healthy, right? So, what kind of food preparations are you giving them, and how are they making these decisions?
Because I'm building my sort of research on from the previous results with hydrogen peroxide, then that is the main sort of medicinal compound that I use also for my studies. But basically, we have this ant food recipe from the 1970s. It's just honey, egg, and agar sort of mixed together with some vitamins usually.
Agar, that's like a gelatin kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can use gelatin in your home kitchen if you're making some gelatinous cake. So it's pretty much that, but then with honey and egg as well to make it nutritious. So that's the base food that I mostly use. And then I can add hydrogen peroxide to that food. So I can supplement it with hydrogen peroxide to make it medicinal. And then I give usually either one of these foods, or then they get a choice of both. And then I follow their foraging choices.
That's interesting. How did you select hydrogen peroxide versus other compounds that might be available in nature, which ants might be using to, self-medicate?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the reason I'm using hydrogen peroxide is because that's the thing that sort of worked before, and if it's not broke, then I shouldn't break it. But the study that I'm sort of continuing as well, it's what my supervisor did, and I'm sort of continuing her research on it. And I think they chose hydrogen peroxide partly because it's a naturally occurring compound, right? It's part of the reactive oxygen species. It's an oxygen that is very reactive, and hydrogen peroxide in sort of everyday life for us humans would be bleach. So it's part of the cleaning products, for example. But I think, yeah, partly because it's a naturally occurring compound, they've shown that it's harmful against the fungus. But I think partly it's also rummaging around the cupboards and seeing what you have and then finding that connection to naturally occurring compounds as well. And they managed to strike gold with it. So that's what I've been continuing with as well.
Right, so ants use kind of bleach as their medication.
Yeah, to put it in very sort of easy terms, that might be a bit oversimplified. But yeah, they apparently can use bleach to cure themselves against the fungal disease.
And I assume that this is kind of not in the liquid form of bleach as we know it.
The hydrogen peroxide uses is in a liquid form as well, but it's gotten from the pharmacies. I don't use cleaning bleach for it for sure, no.
That somehow makes more sense that it's like a lab compound, not so much the stuff that you can find in your local supermarket.
Do you have like specific concentrations at which you dilute it?
So the concentration that I've been mostly using with hydrogen peroxide is 4% in the food, but that's also for like a natural compound, that would be quite high concentration of hydrogen peroxide as well. But again, it's more of a thing that it's worked before. So now I'm just trying to make the entire system work. And when the system's working better, then I can start experimenting more with higher concentrations and lower concentrations. But the previous study that showed that they can use it actually did it with a higher concentration as well. And they actually could show that the ants were still using the hydrogen peroxide to cure themselves, but they were dosing differently. So they were actually able to sense the concentration of hydrogen peroxide in the foods and then dose themselves accordingly.
Oh, that's so cool that they're able to regulate how much they take of it as well. Is there a place where they can naturally find hydrogen peroxide, when they're actually out in the world? Do they find it from nature somewhere?
Yeah, so where ants would get these compounds in nature is a big part of my PhD thesis because it's something that we really don't know. Like I said, I'm using hydrogen peroxide in artificial foods, and that's not really a natural diet, but it is still a very naturally occurring compound. Like it is part of the immune signaling for humans and ants and everything, but it's also part of the immune signaling in plants, for example. So when plants are attacked by herbivores, they have this reaction to upregulate and create these reactive oxygens, and hydrogen peroxide is one of them, to battle the herbivores, both directly because it's a harmful compound, right? It causes oxidative stress and tissue damage. That's why we eat blueberries and other antioxidants when we get oxidative stress. But it's also indirectly because it's part of their immune signaling as well. So we thought that nectar in plants that are attacked by herbivores could be a source for them, but my own results actually counteract that hypothesis. But we used an aphid as the herbivore, and we found that the aphids themselves contain a lot of reactive oxygen. So I've shifted my research towards looking if aphids would be a source of medicine.
So aphids, they're the little green bugs that you find on leaves, right?
Yeah, that are usually destroying your house plants and stuff.
Makes sense. So basically, the aphids destroy the plants, causing plant stress. And then the plant makes the nectar or something, which then has the hydrogen peroxide, which the ants use as self-medication.
Yeah, that was the working hypothesis that we had, that we managed to disprove ourselves, that it doesn't really work like that, that the nectar didn't contain the hydrogen peroxide. But now we're looking into if ants would eat the aphids when they're sick, then maybe they could get healthier faster.
Oh, that's so cool. And this is like a really good example of how science works. You know, you have your theory, your hypothesis, and then you're like, okay, let's test it. And then it isn't always exactly how you thought it is. But then you kind of go on and make this new theory.
Oh, yes, that there's been plenty of failures along the way.
Very much a part of the process in science and research. So now the theory is that aphids themselves, these little green bugs, could be the medication containing the hydrogen peroxide for the ants.
Yeah, we did see that they contain a lot of hydrogen peroxide, but it's impossible to say if it's the hydrogen peroxide that's actually would make them better. We're using hydrogen peroxide more of a proxy, but an aphid is a creature that contains lots of other lipids and proteins and enzymes and everything. So it could be any one of them. But I did run an experiment this summer where we looked more into this, where we, instead of putting hydrogen peroxide into artificial foods, we now crushed entire aphids into it. And we could see that there was a slight medicinal benefit. If they had a sort of a varied and balanced diet that contained aphids, then it might have some help against a fungal infection. So it's looking like aphids could be a potential source of medicine for ants in nature, but we still need to confirm it better with more results and more experiments.
It really sounds like there are so many things and directions where you could take this.
Yeah, there definitely is. And no one else really looked into this. And I'm just looking at like one compound in a way. I'm looking at hydrogen peroxide, but it could be many other compounds. And now I'm just focusing on aphids. But hydrogen peroxide can also be found in like a decaying organic matter, like carcasses and stuff. And we know that ants forage on carcasses, but we have no idea if it gives them a medicinal benefit or not. So it's a very nice place to be as a researcher because in a way it's like a wild west. I can just choose a compound and go with it because no one else has really looked into it. So it's definitely an open thing to go at.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. Like a really nice place to be, as you're saying. Maybe not so common in all fields. You really get the perks of trying new things and really piloting. And it seems like the fun part of science, like a playground almost.
Oh, yeah, it definitely is. It does have its perks, except then when you have to tell other people, you know, you have to justify what you're doing, because that's usually what I get people asking me, that how will this help save the world? And then I have to try to come up with a clever answer instead of saying just because it's interesting and cool.
Yeah, basic science is definitely very valuable, and we need to do research for the sake of research as well. But that actually reminded me of another question. How are we going to save the world with your research? So the Science Basement's theme right now is intersections. So kind of how topics intersect with other topics. And one way that I guess ant research intersects with other fields is at an ecosystem level. So let's zoom out from the ants for a moment and consider ants and ecosystems. Could you talk to us a bit about that?
Yeah. So ants are actually really important for many ecosystems because they are often a sort of a dominant species within them. So you can find ants pretty much everywhere in the world. So they're always going to be present in a terrestrial ecosystem, and they interact with a lot of their environments. So they are generalists when it comes to their diet. So they will capture anything that's moving and drag it back to the nest and eat it. But they also have a lot of these mutualistic interactions. So helpful to both sides interactions with their environments. They protect plants for nectar. They can even protect aphids against predators for honeydew that they secrete, which is also a sugary liquid. And then they can also be a part of seed dispersal for plants, even pollination for some plants, even though that's much rarer. But they still play a big part in their ecosystem. And they're considered to be what we call ecosystem engineers because they have a disproportionately high effect on their ecosystems that they reside in.
So you mentioned that they're ecosystem engineers and, you know, they're super important for us. And I've been hearing a lot about insect losses everywhere. So what happens if we lose our ants?
I think if we lose the ants, we are in big trouble because they do keep a lot of things in check in an ecosystem just with their behavior and interactions with the other species. And if we lose that, then these benefits that all the other creatures in the ecosystem are getting from the ants, they suddenly lose that. So this might lead to huge disbalances in these systems and could lead to maybe the loss of some for sure. Ants are a little bit, I think, underappreciated because when we're talking about insect loss, we only hear about honeybees, right? So that we're losing the bees. And if we lose the bees, we lose all the fruit and we lose everything. And I don't remember what it was said, how many years after bees, humanity will also fall. But I also genuinely think that this also applies to ants because they do keep many of the ecosystems running.
So should we intervene? Is there any way we can help them?
I think that's a good question. And that's sort of a type of question that we often get, that how are we supposed to help this? And how are we supposed to help ants? I usually say that you help ants and most other creatures by just like helping the entire ecosystem as a whole. Maybe don't chop down the forests or don't create massive monocultures and everything. So it's more of helping a system more than helping just one species, because when the system is healthy, so are the species.
So I guess we have to take care of biodiversity in general and really protect the planet is what I'm getting from what you're saying.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, just with the research I'm going to, and now we're seeing that maybe aphids are a source of medicine for ants, even though I can't confirm that yet. If it would be the case, and aphids are like a huge pest species around the world, and we want to get rid of the aphids, if we get rid of the aphids, we might get rid of a source of medicine for ants, and maybe then they will be dying more of disease as well. So it's not just about helping the one species, but the entire system.
Very wise words. And I think maybe this is like a great place to wrap up our episode as well. But before we do, Yasun, what take-home messages do you have for our audience today?
If I have to give a take-home message, then probably be just that ants are really cool. And we could learn a lot from them. And they're not as simple as maybe we think, especially thinking about my topic and how they keep their colonies from having these disease outbreaks. It is something that humans could definitely learn from and maybe should have learned from before we had the plague that's been changing our lives over the past years.
Yep, a very important lesson. So we should really look at what the ants are doing and maybe apply some of the stuff from there. And I also really love this ecosystem perspective that you gave us about. It's not just about protecting one single species, because everything is interlinked at the end of the day. And so I think that brings us to the end of this podcast episode. Thank you, Yasun, so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. But listeners, before you go, Pratakshi has her fun fact prepared for us. So Pratakshi, what's your fun fact for today's episode?
So since we talked today about protecting our biodiversity and we discussed the wonders of the natural world, today's fun fact is another addition to that. So did you guys know that sunflowers are used to clean up radioactive waste?
I had never heard that. Yasun, had you?
I didn't know that sunflowers could do it. I know that some plants and some fungi, but I didn't know that sunflowers.
Yeah, so not only are they aesthetically pleasing, they're also known as hyperaccumulators, which means that they have the ability to soak up large amounts of toxic waste given the right conditions. And because of that, scientists have planted large fields of sunflowers in places of nuclear accidents such as Chernobyl and Fukushima. When I heard it, I was like, wow, like imagine like ruins and there's like a field of sunflowers. That's like such an iconic image.
It seems very poetic, I have to say. That's a really fun fact.
Yeah, also like they are the official symbol for nuclear disarmament, like sunflowers are, which is also like super cool.
Yes, and now that makes so much more sense, actually. Thanks for sharing that with us today, Pratakshi. So thank you very much, Yasun, for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure, super fascinating conversation. And thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in. And till next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. The Science Basement.
If you like this episode, give it a thumbs up. Rate us on the podcasting app of your choice, and don't forget to share it with your friends. This podcast was produced by The Science Basement, a science communication organization based in Helsinki, Finland. Interested in getting involved or being interviewed? Get in touch at podcast@thesciencebasement.org.